The world's most widely used pesticide has been found to be the likely cause of serious birth defects in large mammals, like humans. So we ask, how did pesticides become the weapon of choice for farmers?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned in to the 1212th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Monaco. Tuned in is the Food Chain Podcast at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, we've all heard stories about the plight of bees, and we think, poor bees. But a recent study conducted by scientists in South Dakota has found that the world's most widely used family of pesticides, the neonicotinoids, is likely causing birth defects in white-tailed deer. And that is raising concern over the chemical's potential to harm larger animals, like you and me. In fact, researchers at the Centers for Disease Control have found neonics in nearly 50% of the urine samples collected from people during its recent survey. In other words, half of us are loaded up with neonics. How did it get in us? Another study published this year, Trends in Neonicotinoid Pesticide Residues in Food and Water, found neonics on nearly 60% of cauliflower, 46% of spinach, and 30% of apples intended for human consumption. In other words, the neonics are on, or in, about half of what we eat, and therefore in half of us. In bugs, neonics bind to chemicals that transmit messages throughout the bug's nervous system and cause neurons to fire off uncontrollably. In doing so, the neonics are highly toxic to a wide variety of insects, like bees. Mammals and birds, however, are said not to have the same reaction to neonics, which is why the family of pesticides has become so widely used throughout the food chain, and why a good 50% of us are now saturated with the neonics. Now, large animals, like white-tailed deer, are said to be suffering birth defects due to the neonics, leads us to ask, how did the pesticides become the weapon of choice for farmers? And here to help us find an answer, we have Annalise Abbott, who is an ag journalist that I often find in Acres USA. Annalise, welcome back to the Food Chain.
Oh, thank you, Michael. It's good to be back.
Now, you're working on a book about Malabar Farm, and in the course of doing so are turning up a lot of interesting information about the history of our pesticide use, right?
Yes, I've discovered my book on the history of Malabar Farm is covering the time period of the 1940s and 1950s, and I've discovered that Lewis Blomfield, who started Malabar Farm during that time period, wrote about a lot of issues that seem very relevant today. And yet, when you look at the general literature, you don't see much mention of that time period in issues like pesticides. And so I saw Bromfield talking about pesticides, and he was concerned about pesticide residues in foods. And I was like, okay, so where did Bromfield get his information from? And that started me investigating the history of pesticides, which I discovered there's been tons written on the topic. So I wasn't able to study absolutely everything. I only had like 100 sources or so, but I was able to get a pretty good idea of what happened in the 1940s and 1950s, especially related to DDT.
Good. And DDT was what caught my attention because, in essence, a lot of what you said in your article, and the title of that article, interestingly enough, Pesticides in Total War, a lot of what you said about DDT is ringing true. It's almost like deja vu all over again with respect to the neonics, because much of what was said about DDT at the time, well, it doesn't kill bugs, but it doesn't harm people. It's really the foundation of the intellectual argument for the neonics as well as most everything else. So did you see that? I mean, are we keep going and back to the same places and ending up with the same problems?
Yes, I really do see a lot of similarities, not just with the neonics, but glyphosate and all these other debates about pesticides today. I feel like if we would have really learned the lessons from DDT and these other chemicals 70 years ago, why do we keep doing the same argument over and over? Because what I've discovered is that in reality, the argument does not come down to science. It comes down to emotions and philosophies.
And money.
And money, yes.
And money.
Start out with money.
There you go.
Later.
Follow the money. Well, you know, this neonic study out of South Dakota is most interesting to me because the scientists there are asserting that it appears as though that neonics are responsible for a large number of birth defects in white-tailed deer. And neonics are not supposed to have any effect on mammals or birds. And yet, this is a relatively new discovery, and people are scratching their heads about it and trying to come to grips with it. But it really is exactly kind of what happened with DDT way back when. DDT was said not to have any impact, and yet it did have an impact. And so it is like deja vu all over again. And it will be interesting to see what comes out of this South Dakota study. But you know, to really get a grip on it, I think let's go back to way back when. Actually, it was even before the 40s that our use of pesticides really did start, did it not?
Yes. One of the books I read by a historian dated it back to a little bit before World War I to one of the heads of the USDA called Leland Ozzie-Howard. The guy who had been the head of the USDA's Bureau of Entomology before that, his name was Riley, he was really pro-biological control. So that would mean, you know, encouraging birds to eat insects, you know, picking insects off plants manually, using cultural practices to make sure that, you know, you, like, stay with the hedge and fly on wheat. If you plant your wheat late enough in the season, you're not going to have a problem with it, unless you plant your wheat too early. So they had discovered all of these things back before the turn of the 20th century.
Well, in all due respect, it was how we did things forever, right?
Well, it's hard to say forever talking about the United States because agriculture in the United States is so new relatively
right.
compared to the rest of the world that they had different climates and all that, so they were still just kind of figuring that out throughout the 19th century, what worked best in the United States.
I was thinking of Farmers of 40 Centuries, F.H. King's book, you know, when
mm-hmm.
a USDA secretary goes to China to teach the Chinese how to use Western technology and realizes that, of course, this nothing in our Western technology for farmers who have survived 40 centuries by doing things in an entirely different way. And so there we are. But at any rate, we used biological techniques before we came to chemicals. That's just the way we did things. It was the way my grandfather did things. He didn't have any chemicals. It was just nature and the management of those natural processes. So what was it that caught the science, USDA's eye way back in 1937? What was it that made them stop and think, well, we have to use chemicals now?
Well, like I said, the historians have three main factors, actually, that they say is what caused this shift. The first one was this director of the USDA's Division of Entomology, Leland Ozzie-Howard. So he had tried doing some biological controls. At that time, it was really popular to, if you had a pest, to try to import some kind of predator or natural enemy that would kill that pest. And they had a couple times that it worked really well. It didn't always work, and so he didn't have much success with it, so he decided that biological control isn't going to work. And so he was more in favor of pesticides. So the problem was, at that time period, there were pesticides on the market, but they were not regulated, and so half the time they didn't work. They were just fraudulent stuff. They were ineffective. So what he did was establish a laboratory at the USDA's laboratory in Vienna, Virginia, and there they would test pesticides. I found an article from Scientific American that described it as the United States government has a bug farm. And so they were talking about they were raising dogs to test flea repellents on, chickens to test lice on. They even would have somebody go out in the woods to get bit by mosquitoes to test mosquito repellents and see if they work. And so they actually tested these compounds to make sure they were effective, and then they would be labeled as such so that consumers could actually know that what they were buying really was what the label said it was.
Wow. Consumer protection.
Yes. And this was during the progressive movement. This is the same time that you had the pure food laws first came into effect in 1907. This is the same time period that that happened.
And so people started paying attention then to what was going into their food all of a sudden.
Yes. And then the third thing that changed beyond, you know, this slight change in philosophy really accelerated during World War One. So it really started even before World War II, during World War One. That was when chemists really started being important in the war, like inventing poison gases and all these other things for war. And so this mentality of total war really started back then. They didn't call it total war until a little bit later, but this idea, you know, of trying to destroy everything to use chemistry to win a war. After the war, the chemists were out of a job, and so they needed to keep their job. And so they're like, okay, let's see, we're not fighting against humans anymore, but we have these enemies, these insects. And some of the things they said about the insects were quite extreme. You know, they're like, oh, they're going to, you know, cause the death of the human race if we relax our vigilance even for a moment. They called it like a critical situation. They said the issue is vital, no less than the life or death of the human race. If man wins, he will remain the dominant species on the earth. If he loses, he'll be wiped out by this, his most ambitious racial enemy, was what one person said in 1925.
So, total war. We're not just going to horse around here. We're gonna go total war, and it was wartime too. We're looking at World War One and the transition to World War Two. Apple growers had something to do with it as well, didn't they?
Yes, and this had a lot to do with economics, interestingly, as I've looked into this.
Well, before we pick up the dollars, we've got to take a quick break. But I'm going to reintroduce you folks. We're talking with Annalise Abbott, who is an ag journalist. You can find her material often in Acres USA, one of my favorite magazines. And also watch for a book she's bringing out called, the topic will be Malabar Farm, which is a very interesting place in history of our agriculture. Today we're talking total war on insects with pesticides and what that means to us. And how is it finding its way into our bodies right back?
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What in the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, we finally got to where it all starts, and that's with money and the apple growers of the Pacific Northwest, who are essentially competing with the apple growers of the Atlantic Northeast. And it took a lot of competitive know-how to be able to grow apples on one side of the country and sell them on the other side. And how does that relate to pesticides, Annalise?
All right. So it seems to be that what really started the pesticide use in apple growing was when the railroads made it possible for the growers in Washington and Oregon to ship their apples all the way to New York City. Before that time, New York City got its apples from New York or Pennsylvania, from the regions close around. Because it was close enough, the eastern apple growers could tolerate, only 85 to 90% of good fruit if they lost 15% of their apples. Oh, well, you know, they could still make a profit marketing the rest to the city. So they didn't really need pesticides. But the problem was these growers in the Pacific Northwest, because it was so far to ship their apples, they felt like they could only compete if they had a superior product. And so they were the ones who really started the heavy-duty pesticide spraying with lead arsenate, mostly, during the interwar years, the first half of the 20th century. So they were spraying the lead arsenate because they said, if we don't get 100% perfect fruit, then we can't compete economically with the New York apple growers. So it wasn't so much that there would have been no apples, it's just it wouldn't have been economical for them to ship them all the way across the country.
Lead arsenate?
Yes. That,
was there nobody around that knew what lead did at that time?
Oh, yeah, they did. They knew it was toxic. So there's a really interesting book called Before Silent Spring, written by, let's see, James Roaches. So that is really interesting because he covers this whole history of arsenic as a pesticide. They started out with Paris Green and London Purple, which were both arsenic-containing pesticides, but they were replaced mostly by lead arsenic, and everybody knew arsenic was poisonous. And they even knew that there were sometimes enough residues on the outside of the apples that they could be dangerous. But they tried to invent machines that could wipe them off and all that. Sometimes they worked, sometimes they didn't. Back then, because it didn't really go into the apple, if you peeled your apple, you'd probably be okay, not getting too much lead arsenate. But it was very political because the FDA was trying to say, no, you can't have all this arsenic on apples. But then the growers are like, but we're going out of business if we don't. And so it was way back then, this politics versus consumers versus growers was going on even before World War II.
And it hasn't changed a bit, has it?
Not really, no.
Goodness sake. Well, you know, the big transition then was first the transition from biology to chemistry, right?
Yes.
Where we used to do things with biology and managing the biological systems of nature. Then we discovered chemicals and how chemicals could step in and make things a little bit easier, and thus the lead arsenate we were putting on apples and shipping them to the folks on the East Coast. Wow. But the big another big transition is into World War II, because that's when we really got clever at making up some interesting weapons, right?
Yes, and what's really interesting about that is that DDT was first synthesized way back in the 1870s. So the technology to make it existed for, what would that be, like almost 70 years before it was actually used. And so the interesting thing is then it wasn't even so much a breakthrough in chemical technology as in a different way of thinking about using chemicals to kill insects.
Well, it wasn't even developed to kill insects, was it? It was developed as part of the dye industry, as I understand your writing.
Yes, it was basically just an organic chemistry student's, you know, thesis project. He said, look, I do this reaction, I get this chemical, I record its properties, I move on. That was all it was.
And they're sat for a long, long time until somebody in, where was it, Germany?
In Switzerland.
Yeah. How was it the Swiss are so clever with this kind of stuff? You get Siebert-Geigy, which is the company that, I guess, developed the Neonix, and you have, what, the giant Syngenta now. You have Bayer AG, I think German, though. But at any rate, who was it that started developing the Neonix out of this process of, or I guess it was DDT. We're still working DDT then.
Yes. So DDT was developed by Geigy, the Swiss chemical company. Way back, it was separate. There were three main chemical companies. There was Ciba, there was Geigy, and there was Sandoz. And then they all merged. They're all Syngenta now.
Okay.
But back then, they were all separate in the 1930s. And so the credit is given to a chemist named Paul Muller. He was given the assignment of developing a synthetic insecticide that was very toxic to insects, but not that toxic to animals or plants, that works really quickly, that had a really long action. They wanted it to not have to reapply it too frequently, and they wanted it to be inexpensive.
Kind of the holy grail of pesticides.
Yes, exactly. And so that's what they tested over 45,000 different compounds. And then they finally discovered one. They called it dichlorodiphenyltrichloroethane for short. The full name is like 2,2-bis-p-chlorophenyl-1,1,1-trichloroethane.
Did you practice that?
If you're an organic chemist and you want to know the details, because of course dichlorodiphenyltrichloroethane could be several different compounds, you could call that.
But it was DDT.
Yes, and so everybody just called it DDT. That's what it became known as because that's much easier to say.
Mm-hmm. And so they discovered that, this stuff works, and so they started testing that on lab animals, correct?
Well, in Switzerland, I didn't get a lot. They did a little bit. I don't get the idea that they did intensive testing in Switzerland before they released it. Maybe it's just because I was only looking at the English literature, but I was reading more about the tests they did in the United States were a lot more extensive. So they first patented it in Switzerland in 1942.
And this is during World War II.
Yes, during World War II. And so that's another interesting thing in the story because everybody, the American propagandists were like, oh, yes, you know, the Allies are so much better, you know, because we developed DDT and the Germans didn't. But the reality is Switzerland being neutral in World War II, they felt like it was their duty to release it both to the Germans and to the Allies. So the Germans had access to it also, but they were concerned that it might be toxic to humans, plus all their chemical factories got bombed, and so they couldn't really make it, so they didn't use it as much.
Well, so here we have this stuff, and we start using it, and interestingly enough, we use it for a very important campaign in Naples.
Yes, the typhus epidemic. So the problem with Naples was that there's a war going on. There's all these refugees crowding into the city. There just plain were not enough sanitary facilities for them. People could not wash. And the problem with lice is what the literature I read said, that if you take a bath and change your clothes just once a week, you're not going to get lice. So it's only in like really filthy, dirty conditions that lice are a problem. But lice also carry a deadly disease called typhus, and in those kind of crowded, unsanitary conditions, it could spread pretty quickly from one person to another.
Which is kind of the worry we're seeing in some of the homeless situations in our larger cities.
Yes, it could always be a concern. So what they did was they were like, okay, we know that typhus is a problem. We know this has been a problem in lots of wars. And so the Americans were proactive. They had louse-killing powders using the natural insecticide pyrethrum, which was actually really effective at killing lice. So these powders worked. They were very effective. But the problem was that their whole supply of pyrethrum was imported from Japan. And so, of course, the United States declares war on Japan. They're not going to be sending us pyrethrum anymore. So the problem was they had to try to come up with something that would work as good as pyrethrum when they couldn't get the pyrethrum, and that was why they were so interested in DDT.
Wow. We could not make our own pyrethrum?
I don't know about, I'm thinking it's a, I'm not sure exactly about that, but if we could, we didn't have enough time to do it or something. It's made from a chrysanthemum flower.
There you go. I'm not sure.
But, yeah, that's true. If it grew in Japan, you would think it should grow in the United States. So I'm not 100% sure why they didn't consider that as an option, but they did.
Well, in any case, it really didn't work in Naples.
Yes. And so but the problem was they were running out of it. So it did work. The other thing that all of these stories, they will say, you know, DDT gets all the credit for, you know, stopping the epidemic. Some more cynical observers said, well, really it was they had a better case reporting system, so they figured out who had typhus, and then they had a better dusting system that they could use so people didn't have to take their clothes off, so it was a lot easier to dust people with the pesticide. And so the reality is they could have stopped the typhus epidemic with pyrethrum if they had enough of it.
But they didn't, and so they used the DDT, and then that is really what cause people to look at DDT and say, maybe we have something here. And then we went from, you know, lice to crop pests, right?
Yes, but it took a couple years because the first tests of DDT on the crop pests weren't very encouraging. So it was toxic to cucurbits, like cucumbers and squash and stuff in that family. Actually, DDT was toxic to it, and a little bit to tomatoes. And then they discovered, oh, it kind of builds up in the soil, too, and then that's not good for the plants. And then they discovered it doesn't even kill all of the common agricultural pests. There's a lot of them that it didn't kill. So for a couple of years there, they weren't sure it would be very valuable in agriculture. But what I didn't have time to mention that much in my article is that DDT wasn't the only pesticide, only synthetic pesticide they were using after World War II. There were a bunch of other chlorinated hydrocarbons they were using, most of which were much more toxic than DDT. And then there was also a group called the organophosphates, which were nerve poisons. Those were actually developed by the Germans during World War II to use in human warfare. And then when the United States took over Germany, they stole all their secrets from their laboratories and started making this stuff to kill insects.
And Then there was an attitude change as well, as reflected in the 1945 science article titled Total War Against Insect Pests. So this is after World War II, and those chemical warfare specialists that you talked about earlier are once again out of work.
Yes, only they weren't as much out of work as they were after World War One, because there was, really the atomic bomb is given a lot of credit for shifting people's ideas, and that was the physicists more than the chemists, but they were both held and like almost deified after the war, like they could do no wrong, you know, they could, so they thought with the atomic bomb, we've cracked the secrets of the universe now, we can do anything, we can be gods, we can take over nature, and we can control it, we don't have to follow the laws of nature anymore, we've somehow broken some boundary. This was what a lot of people, even a lot of scientists, thought at that time.
We split the atom. We can do anything.
Yes, exactly.
We can wipe out bad bugs.
Yes.
And DDT is the weapon, as are several other ones as well. But DDT really came to the fore, did it not? This is our principal weapon?
Yes, DDT was always the most well-known, mostly because of the media blitz it got from the Naples typhus epidemic, and then when it was sprayed for malaria control on Pacific Islands, that was a big thing. They used it in the military. They would just spray all the barracks where the soldiers were. They'd douse their clothes in it. They were, like, covering the soldiers with DDT during the war, because they figured, well, you know, otherwise they're going to get malaria or whatever. This is a lot safer than malaria. And so it was used extensively. And then the media reports were like, you know, DDT is a war hero. DDT saved, you know, millions of lives. They always have kind of general figures like that.
Sure. And the bigger the better.
Yep.
You know, having been in the military, I recall getting dusted and sprayed a number of times. I always wondered what it was, but was smart enough not to ask, I guess. But we have resistors. Not everybody agreed, did they?
Because the interesting thing was that even the military wasn't so sure about using it for civilian use, because it was all about risk-benefit analysis. So what is the risk of using the pesticide versus the benefit you get from using it? And if you're talking about typhus in Naples, it's like, well, the risk is that it might be kind of toxic, but the benefit is that you save people from dying of typhus, so it seemed like, you know, an obvious thing, the benefit is so much greater. But when you're talking about civilian use, they're like, okay, people are going to be exposed to this for a long period of time if you use it in agriculture, and there's not, like, any huge benefit, like, it's not immediately saving anybody's life that you could say. And so they were a little skeptical of whether or not this was really a good thing, but there were no laws to prevent it from being released, so they had to.
So, no laws, go right ahead. Now, you talk about risk-benefit analysis. They were conducting LD50 studies on lab animals. Now, what is that?
All right, so DDT was actually one of the first chemicals that they used the LD50 analysis. So the LD stands for lethal dose, and then 50 refers to 50% of the population. So any kind of organism, be it mice or humans or anything, is going to have a range of susceptibility to a given chemical. And DDT, it was a very wide range, actually. Like, a specific organism might be fine at a dose of DDT that would kill a more susceptible organism, even of the same species, which was why insects got resistant so fast, but even with mammals. And so, well, the LD50 is a measure to say the dose that kills 50% of a population of test animals. And so then that's a really comparable figure. You then can compare that between different chemicals to say, like, this is more toxic than this. And so it's always measured in milligrams of chemical per kilograms of body weight of the animal. And so the lower the number of the LD50, the more toxic it is. A really high LD50 is not very toxic. A really low LD50 is very toxic.
Mm-hmm. And evidently it worked out to their satisfaction that DDT and these other chemicals were safe.
Well, safe relatively.
Relatively, right?
Yeah. Like,
did they ever...
More toxic than arsenic or lead or anything else they were using.
There you go. Well, when we come back, I'd like to go to the resistors, people who stood up and said, not so sure about that. And we'll start with the Delaney hearings of 1950. But in the interim, I'd like to re-up this a little bit. Folks, we were talking with Annalise Abbott, who is a journalist with Acres USA, and we're talking a little bit about the history of our pesticide use. Annalise wrote a piece recently in Acres USA called Total War, and she talked about the use of DDT. And I had just been reading a story about a situation in South Dakota in which scientists are coming to the belief that these neonicotinoid pesticides, which are said to be safe for humans, are now turning up to be the principal cause of birth defects in large mammals like deer. And if you think about it, well, that's not a very good omen for we the people, because 50% of us also have these neonicotinoids in our bodies. So what it portends is that we might be in trouble too. And that's the subject of today's program. We will be right back.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, not everybody agreed to switch from this way of biological way of managing pests and managing the environment. It's much more of a cooperative way of working with nature. Instead, we came up with chemicals that allowed us to conduct total warfare on those elements of the environment which we did not appreciate them taking after our crops, our pests. And so we started using pesticides right between the wars, right after World War I, right before World War II. Once we accepted their use, away we went. But in the 1950s, we stopped and had a meeting, the House Select Committee, to investigate the use of chemicals in food and cosmetics. How did that come about, the Delaney hearings, Annalise?
Well, I was having trouble figuring out exactly how they decided to do it, but there was a lot of concern, a huge undercurrent of concern about all sorts of different chemicals in food. Now, people have mostly looked at the pesticide part of the Delaney hearing, but it's interesting, they looked at a whole bunch of other issues. There was a stilbestrol, which was a synthetic estrogen hormone they were implanting into chickens to make their meat more tender, so that was a big thing. And then there was synthetic dyes, bread softeners.
Now wait, so what's a bread softener?
A bread softener, well, there were several chemicals. There was one that they discovered caused nervous fits in dogs. So the point of a bread softener was this came when they were transitioning to the larger supermarkets that weren't baking their own bread fresh every day. They had centralized bakeries. And so normal bread, if you just bake bread with just flour and water and, you know, just normal ingredients, it'll go stale pretty fast if you just leave it sitting out on a shelf. You can't leave it sitting out for a week. It will go stale. But these bread softeners, you see, would make the bread stay soft and squishy even if it was a week or two old. And so part of the argument was like, hey, we're cheating the consumer because she thinks this is fresh bread and it's actually really old, because they were like, the consumer tests the bread, like playing the piano on the loaf, to squeeze them all to see if they're, and they picked the softest one, was the theory anyways.
And, well, I remember that from grade school and having bread fights with little spitballs we made of bread. And we all remember that kind of stuff. And it was really a transition from a homegrown kind of food economy to a industrial scale economy that was facilitated by these chemicals, correct?
Yeah, and this was even more, like, I would say at that time, it probably wasn't a big change in people baking bread at home, because I hadn't been doing that as much, like, even at the beginning of the 20th century, but it was more a consolidation of, like, you have your local bakery, you go right to the bakery and get your bread, to you have the supermarket that's part of a chain, you have a centralized bakery that sends out the bread, and so it's got to travel longer, and, you know, otherwise it'll be stale by the time it gets to the store.
So we go farther and farther and farther away from the source of our food.
Yes.
So the 1950 Delaney hearings, the House of Representatives Select Committee decided to have this conversation, and I assume it had a lot of proponents show up to speak up in favor of pesticides.
Yes. Most of the people who testified about pesticides were favorable because, you see, this whole idea was chemicals in food. So the big thing they were trying to figure out with the way that the pure food law was as of 1938 was when they had last revised it, and it said that there was no tolerance of any substance in food that was found to be injurious to health. And so the question was, okay, pesticides are toxic. Should we allow any residue of pesticides in food at all? And they had already decided with milk, because milk was a food that's fed to infants or to elderly people or sick people, they had already set a zero-tolerance policy of DDT in milk. So farmers were not allowed to use DDT in their dairy barns or spray it on their cows or anything already by 1950.
So there it was. But a lot of people stood up, and there were very important people, scientists with very big companies, who stood up and said, well, wait a minute, maybe this is such a good idea.
Yes. So the concern about DDT being toxic, they knew this. It's interesting that they knew all this back by 1945, before they released it. So they discovered that it would accumulate in body fat because it's fat soluble. So they discovered that it actually would accumulate in the body fat. It wouldn't necessarily be eliminated right away. And they discovered that lactating animals would secrete it in their milk. So they had this one study. They fed it to goats, and then they fed the milk from the goats to rats, and then the rats died. And then the mother rats that were nursing baby rats, the baby rats died. So the DDT was actually transmitted in the milk twice in that experiment.
And you have one doctor here who stood up and said, well, you know, my patients are not looking for this. Dr. Moore Biskind.
Yes, Dr. Biskind, or Biskind, I'm not sure exactly how to say it, but it was really interesting. So he kind of explained, and I wasn't able to put anywhere near all of it in the article that will be coming out this month because there was a really long testimony he gave. It was a very well-done testimony, but he said, you know, I had these people that had these strange symptoms. They included gastroenteritis, coughs, sore throats, joint pain, fatigue, headaches, and this weird kind of nervous apprehension. Like they just had this strange symptoms, and they weren't really. There was no disease that was causing it, and there were also other reports of this. They just call it virus X, X being the unknown, because they didn't know what it was. And so Dr. Biskind was like, well, what's up with this? And then he was reading an article about the symptoms of DDT poisoning. And he's like, hey, wait a minute. These are the exact same symptoms as I'm seeing in my patients. And so then he said, okay, I'm going to ask my patients, have they been exposed to DDT or other pesticides? And it turned out that they had. So there were, at that time, they had these things called pesticide vaporizers that they would put, in restaurants and other public places. They would actually heat up pesticides and release, this steady stream of toxic fog into the air. And so people were just breathing this.
Total
and some
war.
Of them had been exposed to that. Some of them, there was one lady who had sprayed all her clothes in her closet because she was worried about moths. There were several people who sprayed their beds to kill bed bugs when they didn't even have any bed bugs. It was just, completely unnecessary, but they'd been convinced, let's spray our bed to kill bed bugs. And then there was one guy who actually worked as a pesticide applicator, and he was really sick, but he was spraying DDT and chlordane, which was another really toxic pesticide at the time.
Dr. Biskind made an interesting comment at the Delaney hearing. He said, somehow, in a short 5 years, people seem to have forgotten that we had good crops, even immense surpluses prior to 1945, with the use of the methods that had been available. So he's saying, what are we doing here?
Yes, because they were already arguing, even then, you need pesticides to feed the world. And he's like, well, wait a minute. The whole problem with the Depression was that there was too much of everything, and so the farmers couldn't stay in business because they have surpluses. And then shortly after World War II, the same situation occurred. So, and it still is. That's why farmers, dairy farmers especially, are going out of business because there's too much milk, and so the prices are too low. And so this has been the chronic problem in American agriculture's surpluses. And so he's saying, well, if they're producing too much food anyways, then do we need pesticides? I mean, if we took a little bit of a cut in yields, it wouldn't be a big deal, right?
And it wouldn't have been.
No. Well, we don't really see the interesting thing about this all is something that I realized that I did this, the pro-pesticide people, you know, said, oh, well, you can't produce food without pesticides, you know, everybody will starve. They painted these really dire, terrible things that would happen, but they were all emotional arguments. They never had factual basis, and the Delaney Committee wanted them to prove that pesticides were necessary, and they, like, hemmed and hawed, and they said, you know, they just used all these emotional arguments, but they never were able to prove it. So even though everybody said they were necessary, they really didn't have any data to support that claim ever.
Now, you bring up Malabar Farms and Lewis Bromfield, who after roughly the same time was pointing in a different direction.
Yes, and what's really interesting about Bromfield is that he was the only farmer who testified in this entire Delaney hearing. The others were all, like, agricultural extension specialists or, you know, heads of a growers industry, but he was the only one who actually testified as a farmer. And what Bromfield said was that it's all about plant health. If your plants are healthy and they're fertilized properly and your soil has lots of organic matter, then you're not going to need to spray pesticides because there might be a bug here or there, but it's not really going to hurt the crop much. And he had evidence to back that up from several years of farming. So this wasn't just theory. He had actual evidence.
How was he accepted by the House Select Committee? What did they say? They looked at this farmer and said, you're a farmer.
They actually, you know, they thought it was really interesting. You know, they said, oh, we really enjoyed your testimony. You know, thanks for coming. But then when they came down to their final evaluation, they said, well, but he's just one. And all these other people said you have to have pesticides. So, I mean, we have to go with the majority was basically what they decided.
And so we went with the pesticides. And we went with the DDT. But somehow, somebody named Rachel Carson started pointing the finger at DDT. So what happened?
Well, that is a long story. I should be writing three more articles on that. How much detail do you want?
Well, just we have a few minutes. So how did Rachel Carson pull the rug out from DDT?
All right. Well, what Rachel Carson did was she wrote a really good book that brought together a lot of data. All of the data in Silent Spring had already existed. It was buried in all these scientific publications, in the Delaney hearings, all these technical things that you could go to a university library and read them, but the average person really didn't have a good way to access this. I mean, I discovered just going through this stuff now, and it's even easier to get things nowadays, and it still takes hours and hours and hours just to read through it all, even when you get all the articles. So it was a huge job to compile this stuff. And so what Rachel Carson did was she brought it all together, all of this technical stuff from hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of articles, and then she put it in a form that was really readable that the average reader could get. And then she also was already a best-selling author, so she had an audience. She had a good publisher. And so what she did was actually bring all this information together to the public in a way that nobody else had successfully done before.
And what was her essential message about DDT?
It was that, let me see if I can find it. I wrote it down. It was that she wasn't saying we shouldn't use pesticides at all. She was saying, you know, oh, here we go. She said, it is not my contention that chemical insecticides must never be used. I do contend that we have put poisonous and biologically potent chemicals indiscriminately into the hands of persons largely or wholly ignorant of their potentials for harm. So the idea was that we need to rethink this risk-benefit equation. Was that she's not saying just ban pesticides, you know, just without emotionally. She's saying we need to rethink the risk-benefit equation. Is the benefit worth the risk with this information of what the risks really are?
Well, and what happened to DDT after Rachel Carson pointed her finger at it?
Well, it continued. It was very controversial. I believe it wasn't until 1970... Oh, we'll see if I can find it. It was either 1972 or 1974 that it was finally banned. Okay, 72. DDT was finally banned in 1972. There was a huge amount of litigation. I didn't even have time to cover it all. It was very in-depth, but it was all the same arguments that Rachel Carson had used. And then there was this other book called Pesticides in the Living Landscape by, Robert Rudd. And he published that with the University of Wisconsin Press, and that was a more scientific version of the same facts that Rachel Carson put in Silent Spring. So that was an important thing that was used as well. And so a lot of litigation, a lot of fighting against DDT. They finally banned DDT in 1972, and then they banned most of the other chlorinated hydrocarbons in the 1970s, things like chlordane and heptachlorine, dieldrin, which Rachel, if you read Silent Spring, you realize it's not all about DDT. Rachel Carson is talking about a lot of different pesticides,
right,
many of which were even more toxic than DDT.
Right. Now, with respect to the risk-benefit analysis that Rachel Carson was talking about and the Delaney hearings we're trying to come to grips with and that everybody is, just looking at what has happened in the South Dakota white-tailed deer situation, in which a neonicotinoid pesticides appear to be collecting in the bodies of deer and having an impact on their ability to reproduce. And deer are mammals, like we are. So I'm looking at this, and I have a sense of deja vu all over again, that we have accepted relatively recently this pesticide, and here it is, and it appears to be bioaccumulating in us and in the environment. And are we ever going to get straight, Annalise?
Well, I don't know. I think if we would pay attention to history, well, first of all, I think we can learn, first of all, how they managed to again, DDT banned, and it's interesting you bring up the deer because of its impact on wildlife. So the human health thing, Dr. Biskind was concerned about human health, so were a lot of other people. But what they could never do was prove that a pesticide caused a chronic illness. So you can't prove that a pesticide causes cancer or increases your risk of heart disease. It's really almost impossible to prove that because there's so many different factors going on. And the lifetime of a human is so long to try to say, exposure to this pesticide at this time in your life caused your cancer 30 years later. It's really almost impossible to ever prove that. And so when you want to say scientific proof, it's really hard to prove anything other than acute toxicity. Like, oh, somebody ingested this and then they died. Okay, that's toxic. But beyond that, it's really hard to prove it. And so they didn't make any headway with that. It wasn't until they saw the effect of DDT on wildlife.
Well, we just ran out of time. Annalise Abbott, thank you so much for joining us. Folks, keep your eyes open for Annalise Abbott. You can find her often in Acres USA, and she's got a book coming out on Malabar Farm. Thank you, Annalise.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for listening.